Okay, then we go to a couple of annual improvements. And I would like to give the floor to Denise.
Hi, good morning, Mrs. Durant. Good morning, everybody. Today, I would like to address three papers, 2A, 2C, and 2D. And all are related to the annual improvements process. So first, I would like to refer to agenda paper 2A, identification of the code EM and aggregation of segments. If you recall, the board received a request from the European Securities and Market Authority, ESMA, to make some improvements to IFRS 8 operating segments with regards to the aggregation of operating segments and the identification of the code EM, and ask the Interpretations Committee to consider this request. The committee did not recommend the board addressing the issues raised by ESMA through an interpretation or an annual improvement, but thought and expressed their views that requirements in IFRS 8 could be improved somehow in this respect. At the September meeting, the board acknowledged the views from the committee, but asked the staff to explore whether any concerns have been raised in US GAAP in this respect. So in paper 2A, we explored these concerns, and the purpose of this analysis in this paper is to help the board identify how the concerns raised by ESMA could be addressed in IFRS 8. So we have concluded in this paper basically that the aggregation of operating segments has been an area of significant focus of the SEC staff, and also the SEC staff will frequently ask registrants to explain the basis for aggregation and operating segments and identification of the code EM. We think that the ESMA and the SEC share the same concern about providing useful information in this respect, but as we have pointed out in paragraph 21 of this paper, it is ESMA who has specifically asked the board to consider some improvements in IFRS 8 to achieve this objective. So based on this, that's why the staff is proposing to add paragraph 22C as suggested by ESMA. This is in order to supplement the disclosure about operating segments in paragraph 22A. And we also think that the board should amend paragraph 7 to explicitly exclude non-executives from the code EM group. So these amendments are shown in appendices A and B of this paper. And we would like to ask the board if it agrees with our recommendation.
Paul?
Thank you. I support certainly the change to paragraph 22. I think it's a good disclosure. It builds on our requirement already to disclose the significant judgments you make in financial statements, and aggregation of segments is one of them. I'm a little concerned about the addition to paragraph 7 that is on the non-executive directors in two respects. First, our standards are principles, and our principle is chief operating decision maker. We can start elaborating on terms that we use throughout. And I just worry we're going to, throughout all of our standards, and we're going to end up with a book of rules. I would have thought every company would know what a chief operating decision maker is. So that's my first reason for concern. My second is actually the proposed wording in paragraph 7, which is on page 14 of the agenda paper. Which says you're proposing to add a sentence that a non-executive director is not a chief operating decision maker if they don't make operating decisions. Well, that's just circular. You say you're not a decision maker if you don't make decisions.
I thought this was a very wise conclusion.
I can't. It's hard to disagree with it. But do we really have to say it, or is there a better way, such as a non-executive director is not a chief operating decision maker because they're non-executive and therefore they don't make decisions, or something like that? Anyway, those are my two points.
Okay.
I'm really glad that staff has looked at the discussion that took place with the SEC, because some of us were mentioning at the last board meeting to look at what the SEC did, and I'm really glad that staff has done a very good job at that. Building on what I don't have problems with 22A, and building on what Paul just said, my suggestion is slightly on the same lines, and what I wanted to say was, or what I want to say is, non-executive directors are not considered part of the CODM if they do not make operating decisions. This is what you have written. My only point is, why only non-executive directors and operating decision? Anybody who doesn't make a decision is not a CODM. I think what you are trying to say is that generally non-executive directors are not considered to be CODM unless they make an operating decision or something like that, but it should be to anybody. And I think, I personally feel it doesn't need to be in para 7. It can be in application guidance or in basis of conclusion or something like that. It doesn't need to be right here, because you're only stating the obvious in that sense of the word, that whoever makes the decision will be the CODM. Okay. So I think, similar to Paul, I just wanted to add to that.
Doc?
Yes, I understand the staff's proposal, and I think it may improve the financial statement, but I cannot echo with the reasoning. According to your paper, paragraph 22, the last three lines say that regulator might not have the same power to compel reporting entity to explain it. And so does it mean that accounting standard should do more than the regulator? So my concern is, if some other regulators asked us to increase our rules only because they don't have a power to compel, do we do the same thing? So that is my concern. And as far as your proposal is concerned, I think it would make an improvement. However, say, for example, aggregation, in normal circumstance, it is self-explanatory. And majority of companies, most companies' segment information are normally straightforward. I understand there are some companies whose segment report is not very straightforward, but in that case, regulator can ask. And normally, if the segment reporting is, though segment reporting is not very clear, you can understand the situation judging from MD&A or other information. So then, it is not so common that a regulator has to ask what is the point of this aggregation of the segment. So only to make it happen, do we ask the majority of other constituents whose segments are very straightforward to do more in the standard? So my concern is, standard is the rule which compels to all constituents. But what your proposal is trying to achieve is just to penalize some constituents who is not doing well. So that is not the job of accounting standard. That is the job of the regulator. So therefore, I do not really agree with your proposal because of the reasoning that you gave on the paragraph 22.
Beth?
Well, Denise, I strongly endorse these changes. I think the principal issue in this paper is one we really haven't talked about much yet, which is whether or not there should be a clear indication or explanation of the way the segments have been aggregated. It's clear from the paper that the SEC staff struggles with this. This is a frequent issue that is raised in their review of financial statements. It's clear, based on my experience as an analyst, that this is an area where companies have played games in the past, particularly as you see certain divisions or subsidiaries going through a restructuring or an underperforming type of phase in their life, and you end up seeing a loss of information. You see this aggregation effect starting to take place. And that's obviously misleading for anybody's analysis. So I think this is an excellent suggestion and an improvement to our literature. I think it's going to help not only interpretation, but ultimately enforcement, too. So I would strongly endorse making this.
Denise, did you want to respond at all?
Yeah, regarding the identification, I mean, it's clear to me that some of you support adding this paragraph 22C, but regarding the identification of the code EM, would you like me to reword that paragraph or just do not propose any amendment to that paragraph? Because as you were saying, well, it's up to the preparer to determine who is a code EM.
My response to these would be, I would make either way is okay with me. I think the current wording
is a little funny to say you're not a chief operating decision maker if you don't make decisions.
Yeah. Stephen?
Denise, I don't understand what problem we're trying to fix with this paragraph 7.
Well, it's just that I think ESMA was concerned that that directors or executives in a lower level would be considered as part of this CODEM group, and that information would not be, the quality needed to put together or to aggregate operating segments. On the first place, what they wanted, if you have followed their original submission, is that they wanted to emphasize the operating nature or the operating role of the CODEM. That was their first objective. That's why they suggested some other amendments to paragraph 1 and paragraph 7. But at the end of the day, we thought that the strategic role and the operating role are both clear in paragraphs 5 and 7 of IFRS 8. So we were just trying to help them, adding some wording to paragraph 7 to say that non-executives do not make operating decisions.
One way of reading this is that non-executive directors are part of the board. Does that mean the board of directors as a whole cannot be the CODM?
Well, no, not. I don't think so.
So how does it change it? I mean, presumably, I can't imagine anybody is identifying one or a group of non-executive directors by themselves as being the CODM. That's contradictory.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, even I've got a footnote here on page 9 because I have some conversations with the SEC and some committee members. The CEO is almost invariably on the board of directors, is part of the board of directors, but for purposes of identifying the CODM, he's considering his role as CEO, but not his role as part of the board. So in that case, you are right. They could be part of the board of directors, I think.
Amaru?
I was just trying to make the reading easier. If we all agree with this clarification, as I see, I would simply, at the end of the third sentence, include non-executive director or group of non-executive directors, and then you have the same, because if you read, often the chief operating decision-maker of an entity is its chief executive officer or chief operating officer, but, for example, it may be non-executive director or a group of executive directors, and then the later rest. You have the same clarification.
Okay.
I think I'm a bit in, I think, who was it who said first, Paul, was it you saying This is something where we get into details that make it worse. When you focus on the comments you got from the SEC, you have to keep in mind you're talking of a one-tier board. When you go to Europe, you might have two-tier boards. And do you want to address now all variances, or don't we just want to say and make it a solid argument whom we consider to be the chief operating decision maker, and a non-executive is not taking operating decisions and therefore doesn't fit into chief operating decision maker? And I'm getting a bit the feeling that's something we don't need to state for an average person.
Yeah, I must say I also feel sympathetic towards Paul's suggestion to not include this and to limit ourselves to paragraph 22. Indeed, this is, I mean, identification of this person. I cannot imagine that is a big problem in practice.
Then they might have an organizational problem.
And this is indeed something that, for a principle-based standard, to get too specific about it. I'm not enthusiastic about it.
Was that raised by the
PSMA?
Yes.
ESMA.
Yes. Not exactly this amendment. They have suggested another amendment.
What did they suggest?
They suggested amending paragraph 1 and paragraph 7, but it was basically to delete the operating, to emphasize the operating role of the core EM and to de-emphasize their strategic role, which we consider was wrong because that's very clear in the in IFRS 8. So,
I don't disagree with Paul's comment, but I just think that when we're finished, we ought to be responsive to the ESMA. ESMA.
Yeah, first you have to properly pronounce their name, and then. In Brazil, we are called IASB.
So, well, being more specific about the amendment that they have proposed for paragraph 7, they basically were suggesting to delete in the second line of this paragraph where it says that function is to allocate, page 14, that function is to allocate resources to and assess the performance of the operating segments of an entity. They were suggesting to say that function is to be involved in making operating decisions within an operating segment, and then they suggested deleting allocate resources to, so that means de-emphasizing the strategic role, and then they went on with a paragraph. So,
Paul?
My only concern with that, Denise, is you said chief operating decision maker within an operating segment.
Yes.
But our principle in IFRS 8, I thought, is the chief operating decision maker of the entity, not within the segment. So that's a major change.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, all in all, should we just leave it as it is?
Okay.
And satisfy ourselves with the other change?
Yes. Okay.
So just change paragraph 22.
Yes. And let's write ESMA a letter as to the reasoning of what we did. Okay, Denise, go on.
Okay. Well, I would like to refer now to paper 2C.
I saw no disagreement.
I haven't got the reply to my question. The reasoning is the ESMA, am I pronouncing correctly? Might have a power to compel, then asking us to do more. So do we do the same if other regulator asked us to do more, only because they don't have enough power to compel?
Well, I don't think that in itself would be enough motivation for us to act. The fact, though, that an enforcer with ample ample power like the SEC is struggling with this issue might lead us to the conclusion that we need really clear rules.
Okay. Yeah.
Your concern about imposing more burden on the people who do not play with the rules, I think, is not valid because, as you said, when it is straightforward, the segment, and they will not aggregate a segment in that case. They will have segment reporting, which is clear. They will not try to aggregate segments. And if they begin to aggregate segments which are otherwise straightforward, then there is a problem. And then must explain why they do so.
Daryl, did you?
Just very quickly, I think if we are really worried about responding to this, the basis of conclusions you currently have for this section works very well, except in your last sentence, all you say is, consequently, the board believed it was not necessary to make a change because it was clear from there. So you cover the concern that Esme raised, but address it by simply saying, we looked at it and we don't think it's necessary to comment. And I think there's enough explanation in the basis to get you there.
Good. Okay.
Okay, Denise, move on to C, you said, or to B? To C.
Okay. Okay. Paper 2C provides a criteria assessment that the committee used to base its decision to propose an amendment to IS-7 regarding the classification of interest paid that is capitalized as part of the cost of an asset. You discussed and approved this amendment at the September meeting, but unfortunately we had just referred to this criteria assessment, but we have not actually included it in the paper. So this is just to complete our due process. And, well, do you have any question or do you agree with our criteria assessment? Okay. I'm going to move to D.
Yes.
Okay. Paper 2D refers to an issue that the committee did not recommend to be included within annual improvements. In July 2011, the committee received a request to clarify in paragraph 65 of IS 16 the timing of recognition of compensation for insured property, plant, and equipment that has been impaired or lost, for example, as a result of a natural disaster, because they thought that it was unclear the moment when this compensation becomes receivable. The submitter had suggested the committee to propose a clarification of the requirements in paragraph 65 of IS 16 as part of the annual improvements project. The committee analyzed the alternatives identified by the staff to address this issue, which are explained in paragraph 9 of this paper. And a majority of the committee members concluded that the meaning of the term becomes receivable is not ambiguous and can be easily understood as a moment when the compensation right meets the definition of a receivable. As we mentioned in paragraph 11 of this paper, IFRS 9 states that a financial asset, including a receivable, is recognized when and only when the entity becomes a party to the contract and has a legal right to receive cash. Some few committee members, however, did point out that the requirements of IS 16 should not be different from those in paragraph 53 of IS 37 for reimbursements, as we propose in view 1B of the paper. So based on the above, the committee decided to propose the board not to make any amendment to paragraph 65 of IS 16 to clarify when compensation becomes receivable. We would like to ask you if you agree with this recommendation. Yeah, I know.
Pat?
I've already shared my thoughts with Denise, Michael, and Wayne. I would actually prefer to align the guidance here with 37. I think if this has been raised as an issue, we might as well go ahead and provide the guidance. And I think it's an enhancement, an improvement to you know, the literature, which without necessarily changing its meaning. So I think it basically shows the consistency of the standards that we've already developed. So I would actually advocate making this. It's also consistent with the current thinking we've developed in the revenue recognition exposure draft on, you know, when you book revenue or gain. So I think it all fits nicely together. So I'd go ahead and make the change.
BK?
I was not planning to talk on this till Patrick raised the issue to align 37 with this, and I don't agree with this at all. I think the language in 16 is clear for me, and I would leave it there. And for me, honestly, this issue came up in the United States, not exactly in the same thing, when Hurricane Katrina happened, and there was a big debate when to recognize the insurance related to the asset because of huge losses that happened. And I was thinking when I was reading this, it could have happened if Japan was adopting IFRS, and it would have been the same issue in Japan too, not too long ago, unfortunately. So waiting for the 37 to happen would be a total mismatch, and I don't think that is the intention at all. And I think we should leave, if you want to do anything, just leave it as it is, otherwise clarify more. But I wouldn't align at all to 37.
Anyone else? PK? Sorry, Lego.
Yeah, I observed if a discussion. Oh, yes. If the discussions, and I think the effects basis are quite sound. I agree with the proposal.
He agrees.
Okay.
So, who agrees with the staff proposal? Beth, do you agree with the staff proposal?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Every now and then you have to make yourself heard because I might forget because I can't see you.
Don't worry, we'll remind them.
Okay. I'll remind you I'm here.
Okay, very good. 2B. April, please.
Thank you. Yes, if we could look at paper 2B, which is part of annual improvements related to IS 24 related party disclosures. IS 24 specifically identifies persons acting as key management personnel as a related party in paragraph 9. And it also lays out the detailed disclosures required for their compensation, disaggregated between short and long-term benefits, termination, and share-based payments in paragraph 17. Now, in 2010, the committee received a submission asking if key management personnel, as defined in IS 24, only relates to individuals. The submitter presented the case of mutual funds that typically do not have employees, but that hire key management personnel from a separate management entity. And there is significant diversity in practice in both the identification of those relationships and their disclosure. The board have discussed this issue twice before as part of the annual improvements process, in October 2010 and then in September of this year. And the discussions haven't been straightforward, in part, I think, because of the diversity of ways in which the relationship between the reporting entity and the key management personnel can be structured. So paragraphs 11 and 12 of the paper describe these four typical possible structures. Now, if the key management personnel is employed directly as an employee of the reporting entity, the identification of the key management personnel as a related party and the disclosure of the compensation is clear. But where they are compensated indirectly through service entities, the position is not as clear for either identification or for the disclosure. So the paper is structured to firstly ensure that all key management personnel are identified as related parties, and then to ensure that compensation paid to them is adequately disclosed, whatever route is taken to pay the compensation. So the first question for the board is the identification of key management personnel as a related party, and that's discussed in paragraphs 11 to 19 of the paper. individuals are identified separately as related parties by the existing requirements of paragraph 9A in IS 24. Paragraph 9B of IS 24 lists the categories of entities that are currently related entities of the reporting party. The staff agrees with the previous recommendations made to the board that an additional clause be added to paragraph 9B to include service entities providing key management personnel services. And the wording is in paragraph 18. The entity or members of its group provides key management personnel services to the reporting entity. Do the boards agree with that recommendation, and do they have any comments to add?
I see a lot of nods. This was discussed pretty extensively in the previous session, I think.
Okay. I agree. Everybody.
I think we have unanimity here.
Okay. The second area covered is the disclosure of the compensation paid to the key management personnel. Paragraph 17 of IS 24, which is included as paragraph 20 in this paper, requires separate disclosure of compensation to the key management personnel as individuals, and it's in a format which is suitable for employees. The board have discussed in the past whether this format could be extended in some way and applied to the fees paid through entities. For the reasons noted in paragraph 26 of the paper, that disclosure might not be available and it may not be useful in all circumstances. And so for the reasons given in paragraphs 27 through 32 of the paper, the staff do not recommend that fees paid to the service entity be reconfigured into that format. Instead, we recommend that a clause be added to paragraph 18 of IS 24, which is the part that deals with transactions with related entities, to require that amounts paid in respect of key management services be separately disclosed. And in that way, the key management personnel services provided through an entity would be identified as a related party and the compensation disclosed separately. Then for completeness, in paragraphs 34 to 39, the paper goes on to discuss points which have been discussed in the previous meetings, in particular why the staff don't recommend changing the existing definition of key management personnel in paragraph 9A of IS 24, as discussed in October 2010, and that's because of the possible unintended consequences of excluding them from related parties. And in paragraphs 40 to 41, the paper details some of the structuring examples that are possible to illustrate how the key management personnel, whether they're an individual or through a management entity, would be identified as a related party and how the compensation paid to them would be disclosed in each case. So does the board agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 2 that amounts payable for the provision of key management personnel services paid to a separate management entity should be separately disclosed? Now, a board member has suggested that where we refer in the wording to paid, we should also extend that to include or payable, and the staff agrees with that recommendation. The question is posed on page 13, and again, for completeness, there are two further parts to the question. One is to prevent any attempt to disclose fees to the service entity in the form required for the individuals, and the other is to retain the existing definition of key management personnel. So do the boards have any questions on question 2 on page 13?
Do we have another? Oh, PK.
I have a question for you. You suggested that you have thrown a teaser. By the way, the paper is very well written. I have to compliment you for that. You have thrown a teaser towards the end of it that current IFRS, IAS 24, does not talk about variable compensation. You would like to pick that up in the next cycle. Could you elaborate why we can't pick it up in this cycle? The reason is that, for me, the structuring, the reason I'm bringing that up is that no matter how much I read your explanation, I still get hung up on the structuring opportunities that can hide the compensation paid to certain employees by artificially creating a key a structure in between. So maybe to alleviate that concern, perhaps by showing some variable compensation might provoke the questions much more focusedly without tampering this. So as a compromise, I would like to see why we can't take all these issues at the same time and why would we put down the variable compensation to the next annual improvement cycle. Is there any reason? Can you help me?
I think it's just too late in that cycle. As I understand it, I think the pre-ballot draft of the current annual improvements is just about to go out to the board.
Including this?
Not including this. Including points which have been discussed up until date, and including the first two parts, questions one and two. Shall we identify the entities as being a related party, and shall we disclose payments to the entities separately? So that covers the sort of the existing point I think we've got to in our discussion so far. But in doing this work, it came to the staff's attention that actually the existing disclosure about key management personnel doesn't really tell you very much at all. Knowing that they've got termination payments or share-based payments isn't really as interesting in the staff view as whether or not they're about to get a 5-year long-term incentive plan bonus or something, which is why the staff later in question three asked whether or not the boards would like us to look at that in the next round.
But if there is appetite at the board level, which I don't know whether there is or there isn't, if there is an appetite, how much time does it take to add this to the thing? I would think it's pretty straightforward. I could be wrong, but
I mean, I'm just looking desperately at Sue here. I don't know how much flexibility there is in the timing of the ballot draft.
Just to add one more question to it.
I would just say that I think it would be normal for the staff, as it is a new thing, which was not considered in the original IS24, I would have thought the board would want the staff to go away and do some research, perhaps, onto this, and sort of come back in a sort of perhaps a more
I would think that people would like to see all at once in this area rather than spoon-feeding and drip-feeding them one this period and something coming down the next period. I thought that is a very eminent solution you had.
Ian?
Yeah, I'm just worried with this suggestion that it's one step too far. Nobody's complained about this or nobody suggested that it needs to be fixed except the staff when they look at it. And if we're going to start doing these things, shouldn't we put them on our work plan and go through it properly? Do we just pick improvements here or there as we spot them? I think it needs to be thought through in terms of our total work.
I respect that. All I'm trying to say is that this will avoid the structuring issue that some of us are very concerned with it. So it's related to that. It's not unrelated. It's not an existence on its own. It's related to that. But I'll vote no, but then that's fine.
I mean, to April's point, I think that we're trying to prevent the board agreeing to things on the fly. So we'd need to bring a paper, and my understanding was that we wanted to get everything agreed at this meeting in order for the annual improvement package to be tied up. So I think we have a timing issue.
Okay, let me put the recommendation to the board.
I had a question.
Oh, sorry.
In the third question, I guess my personal view is I don't object, but when I read paragraph 18, if I was preparing a set of financial statements, I would view paragraph 18 to cover variable-based payments. And the terms there, so in other words, it's not necessary for the staff to do further work, is my point. Because I think that paragraph 18 requires or imposes on somebody to consider the nature of the consideration. In my mind, nature would cover whether or not it's fixed or variable. So I actually don't think you need to do any additional work. It's already in our guidance.
So can I just ask for question two on disclosure? Was everyone in agreement with that?
I am.
So which one?
Just 2A.
2A?
2A.
2A. Everybody in favor? 2A? Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
2B?
Yes. Beth?
Yes.
Yes? 2C.
Yes.
All set. Yes.
Not PK.
PK was not in it.
Not PK.
Okay, go on, April.
Well, as we've sort of discussed, the final question on Q3, which is on page 13, on page 15, concerns disclosure to related parties more generally. As we've already said, the objective of IS24 is to draw attention to the possibility that the financial statements may have been affected by the existence of related parties and by transactions with those related parties. IS24 specifically requires detailed disclosures of amounts paid to individuals acting as a key management personnel to the reporting entity, and this allows users to assess the possible impact of the behavior of the key management personnel on the entity's financial statements. And as we've said in the staff view, a key management personnel's behavior is more likely to be affected if their compensation is dependent on the reporting entity's profit or financial position. And we think this is most likely to be the case if there's a variable component to their compensation. In the previous board's discussions, which we listened to on the tape, we noted that the topic of bonuses was raised by a number of board members. And at the moment, there is nothing which would separately disclose those payments. So the question to the board in paragraph 51 is, do the board want to the staff to seek further input on the effect of variable payments made to related parties, assess whether separate disclosure of the variable payments would be desirable, and consider any such proposals as part of the 2011-2013 annual improvements?
So do we agree it would be useful that this follow-up work will be done?
I guess.
Yes?
I'll just repeat that. I think this is a revision of a standard. And if we're going to go around revising all our standards every time we see something, I think it needs to be part of a work program, and we shouldn't just do it ad hoc.
So you asking the question essentially, Ian, whether it meets, you know, the requirements for an annual improvement, because that's sort of the tone in here, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I'm not sure it does meet the requirements of an annual improvement. In which case, we're just revising a standard because we think it's a good idea at the time.
So you would tend to say no. Who says yes?
I agree with the staff.
Three, four, five, six, seven, nine.
Nine. Another bit of beefy.
Yes. I'll get her inside.
You have one question left, April?
No, that's it.
Okay. Thank you.